Power on.
Hi, friends, and welcome to the Pop Culture Retro-Rama podcast. I'm your host, Vic Sage, and I'm here to share memories, thoughts, and information on all manner of retro-related properties. Movies.
Are you telling me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Music.
I want my MTV. All right.
Comic books.
These ain't your daddy's comic books, fanboy.
And toys.
It's Castle Grayskull. And it's mine.
Broadcasting to you from the depths of the Retroist Vault. So, come join us, won't you?
Now, you're playing with power.
Friends, thanks once again for taking the time to join us for another episode of the Pop Culture Retrorama podcast. As I've mentioned before, growing up in a single-parent household, a lot of values and beliefs were seeded from my grandparents. Many an afternoon and evening after school, and during what used to seem long summers, were spent with them. I never tired of learning about their lives. What they first thought at seeing 1931's Frankenstein, or what it was like when they were attending school. You get the idea. One of the many ways they influenced me was through both their love of big band music, the Mills Brothers, Dean Martin, and the music of Fats Domino, as well as some classic country and bluegrass singers in a few cases. But more importantly, with the subject of our show for today, they also made me a fan of old-time radio shows. In particular, of that pulp Avenger, that scourge of the underworld known as The Shadow.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
To be fair, it wasn't just the likes of The Shadow. My grandparents told me about a handful of radio adventure serial characters. The Lone Ranger, the Green Hornet. How they would sit and listen in the dark, with the soft glow of the radio flickering as they were chilled by Lights Out, and hearing Chickenheart for the first time. But with my love of comic books, especially Batman, it was The Shadow that I kept asking them about in my youth. And while sadly the recordings weren't readily available for me to listen to as I was growing up, I could find a few books about old-time radio shows at the local library. It was there I was able to get a few precious nuggets of wisdom about The Shadow radio show as a kid. Thankfully, I was in my early teens when our local Hastings started carrying many classic radio shows on cassette, including The Shadow. They weren't exactly cheap either, but they made good birthday and presents on the holidays. The Shadow was born out of the declining sales of Street & Smith Publications' Detective Story magazine, which got its start on October 15, 1915, and remained in publication until 1949, for 34 years, and publishing 1,057 issues. Beginning at the end of February 1931 until 1949, the company was producing a magazine every single week. Notable authors included in its collection of short stories featured the likes of Agatha Christie, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Johnston McCulley, the creator of Zorro, a character I will tackle in a future podcast, and Sax Rohmer, to name a few. It was in 1930, on July 30th, that the Detective Story Hour began broadcasting, and it was this radio show that Street & Smith hoped would help shore up sales with their magazine. Their thinking on this was solid, because while print ads were indeed useful, what could reach more people at the time than radio? They had approached David Chrisman of Ruthroff & Ryan, which was an advertising agency. And Chrisman, along with William Sweets, who was a director as well as a writer for radio, began to adapt stories from the Detective Story magazine. The two men felt that what the show would need to stand out is a memorable host. In this case, a mysterious-sounding character to introduce and close out the show. But the first hurdle was to figure out what to call this narrator. I've read that some of the early thoughts for names included The Sleuth or The Inspector, Which, considering it was a radio show presenting mystery stories, those are worthy titles. It appears to have been Harry Inkman Charlotte, a scriptwriter for the new series, however, that hit pay dirt when he suggested The Shadow as a possible name. Now then, it turns out that this iconic name might have been based off an earlier publication in 1929, from Street & Smith's Fame & Fortune magazine, in fact, in a story entitled The Shadow of Wall Street by George C. Jinks, who was using the pseudonym of Frank S. Lawton. The story for The Shadow of Wall Street involved a hooded figure, at least that's how it was portrayed on the cover of that issue, who waged a secret battle with a group of equally clandestine financiers who are attempting to manipulate the New York Stock Exchange in their favor. This shadow combats this group of greedy financiers by investing in stocks to aid the average investor, who'd be cleaned out if this secret group succeeded. Interestingly enough, the Wall Street crash of 1929 would take place 8 months after the publication of this story. That crash, of course, being one of the causes of the Great Depression. Anyway, the Shadow of Wall Street was described as having a mocking laughter, and in the tale, he sort of has an agent working for him. So there are some similarities to this 1929 story to the way the pulp icon of the Shadow would behave and operate. When that July 30th episode of the Detective Story Hour aired, featuring the voice of James Licurdo as the narrator, now known as the Shadow, a role which he performed weekly for 4 months. Before being replaced by Frank Riddick Jr. The reason that Licurdo left was that he had secured a role in a Broadway production. Besides supplying the voice of the Shadow in the Detective Story Hour, Frank Riddick Jr. is well known for playing the CBS reporter who meets a grisly fate thanks to the Martian invasion provided by Orson Welles' radio adaptation of H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. Orson himself has a connection to the Shadow, but more on that a bit later. Street & Smith did their best to foster the mystery of the Shadow. Frank Riddick Jr. was originally uncredited in the role. In the publicity photos that were sent out at the time, he was seen wearing a black cloak and fedora, with an oversized domino mask obscuring most of his face. To Street & Smith Publishing's dismay, the listening public became far more interested in the narrator of the show instead of the adapted stories that the character served to represent. The newsstand and magazine dealers began reporting back to Street & Smith that customers kept requesting copies of the Shadow Detective magazine. As you might imagine, the publishers realized they needed to start rolling out a new magazine to satisfy the public's demand and fascination with the Shadow. Frank Blackwell, whose job was editor-in-chief, decided to run a contest with honest-to-goodness cash prizes to listeners of the Street & Smith Detective Hour who could figure out the motives and physical appearance of the Shadow. For 10 weeks, 10 clues were dropped during broadcasts, and in the February to April 31st issues of Detective Story magazine, announcements were run that read, quote, $1,000 in rewards for those who display the greatest ingenuity and accuracy in correctly arriving at their conclusions as to what the Shadow looks like. What type of man is he? End quote. What type of clues, you might be wondering? How about this? 8AAA, the salesmen say, and Beau Brummel's tastes are mine, but 40 ways I look, and for 40 persons am mistook. With that clue revealing that the Shadow was obviously a master of disguise, with a slim foot size, but apparently was concerned with his appearance, in his manner of dress. In short, he liked to dress smartly. Or, my favorite, as the unrelenting hound is to the fox, so am I to malefactors. But a whippet gait I take went on the scent. Which some fans successfully construed to mean that the Shadow was a detective, one that would act quickly in his hunt for criminals when he was on their trail. The only obstacle now was finding the perfect person to start creating stories about the character. This was how Walter B. Gibson landed the job, given the task of writing stories for The Shadow by Henry William Ralston, the general manager at Street & Smith, as well as Frank Blackwell. Gibson was not only a newspaper man, but a prolific ghostwriter for the likes of Harry Houdini, Harry Blackstone Sr., Howard Thurston, and the supposed world's leading astrologer, Professor A.F. Seward. In addition, he was an amateur magician himself and penned more than a few books on the arts of sleight of hand, as well as writing articles for other mystery periodicals like True Detective and True Strange Stories. Gibson was on his way back home to Philadelphia, having visited New York City to arrange a sequel to his book, Houdini's Escapes, which was crafted from notes from Houdini himself. While there, he dropped in on Street & Smith, literally carrying his typewriter in its case with him to see if the company might be interested in hiring him for any stories or features in their magazines. After his meeting with Blackwell, he got the job for writing the first Shadow story, and the promise of payment for 3 additional novels if the gang at Street & Smith liked what he turned in. Which they most definitely did, as in the long run, Gibson would provide 282 of the original 325 novels over a span of 20 years. It would end up being a novel-length story of the Shadow twice a month. Walter B. Gibson would take on the pen name of Maxwell Grant, who the stories themselves stated at the beginning of each pulp novel was, quote, from the Shadow's private annals, end quote, as told to Gibson himself. And friends, the popularity of the character, the reason the Shadow is still being talked about today, a mere 89 years after making his debut, as well as being published in new comic book series and even new novels, is largely due to the writing of Gibson. As Gibson himself pointed out in the Shadow Scrapbook, which is hands down one of the greatest sources of information about the character. At the time of creating the Shadow, crime was truly running rampant. Think about it. The shocking events of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre was barely a year old, which is how the seeds of a shadowy avenger that punished the wicked came so readily to Gibson. The first publication for The Shadow, a detective magazine, was in April of 1931, with Gibson's story entitled The Living Shadow. And right out of the gate, it grabs you and makes you want to know more about the Shadow and his world. The author came up with the idea for the opening while visiting with Blackwell at Street & Smith, of a figure appearing from out of the foggy night, stopping a young man from jumping off what is probably the Brooklyn Bridge, as it takes place in New York. This character is Harry Vincent, and would serve as one of the pawns in the Shadow's secret war against crime and other evils. While there are many similarities in the Shadow and the Batman mythos, I need to point out, the latter was published beginning in 1939. Gibson's writing as the Shadow introduces himself of sorts to Harry Vincent shows that this Avenger of the Night is far more unsentimental than the Caped Crusader is to his eventual wards. Listen to this excerpt.
Your life, said the stranger's voice slowly, is no longer your own. It belongs to me now, but you are still free to destroy it. Shall we return to the bridge?
I don't know, blurted Vincent. This is all like a dream. I don't understand it. Perhaps I did fall from the bridge, and this is death that I am now experiencing. Yet it seems real after all. What good is my life to anyone? What will you do with it?
I shall improve it, replied the voice from the darkness. I shall make it useful, but I shall risk it too. Perhaps I shall lose it, for I have lost lives, just as I have saved them. This is my promise. Life, with enjoyment, with danger, with excitement, and with money. Life, above all, with honor. If I give it, I demand obedience. Absolute obedience. You may accept my terms, or you may refuse. I shall wait for you to choose.
As I just mentioned, you can't really see Batman saying that to Robin or Batgirl. After completing The Living Shadow, which was originally entitled Murder in the Next Room, Gibson brought the story to Blackwell for approval, and it was, with one small concession. You see, Street & Smith found themselves working rapidly to get the magazine out, to avoid some other publisher deciding to stake a claim on the name of The Shadow. So, they reused some artwork from a previous magazine, one featuring a Chinese man clutching his neck, with his shadow cast behind him. It's an interesting cover to be sure, but it naturally had nothing to do with Gibson's story in the least. So Gibson quickly altered elements of his original tale to include the Shadow putting Harry Vincent on the trail of a courier for Wong Fu, who happens to be something of a criminal mastermind. Which is how Harry Vincent finds himself in a literal death trap, saved at the very last second by the Shadow, who was disguised as a member of Wong Fu's army of minions. Not that the confused and frightened young man realizes this until he's making his escape, as Gibson's writing points out. As Vincent's hands grasped the rope and he began his precarious trip to the ground, he heard an exultant sound come up the stairway. It was a long, mocking laugh, a strange, unaccountable laugh. A laugh that would chill the heart of a man who had never known fear. That parting jibe told the true identity of the strange rescuer who had chosen a Chinese disguise to enter the house of Wang Fu. Harry Vincent had heard the laugh of the Shadow. I promise I won't be doing quotes like that through the entire episode, friends. I just love Gibson's writing so much, I wanted to provide some excerpts. From that very first issue with The Living Shadow, Street and Smith realized they had an absolute hit on their hands as it sold out on the newsstands. So, Street and Smith quickly contacted Gibson and requested the next story for the following month. Gibson was a powerhouse, as he was not only quick, it's been said that he could churn out a 60,000-word story in as little as 8 days. I read an excellent article on ShadowSanctum.net that pointed out something I had heard before. Gibson was known to type so fast that his fingertips would become bloody. The author has said he had to sometimes tape cotton balls to the tips of his fingers to make it more manageable. Featured in both that article, as well as the Shadow Scrapbook, is a full-page advertisement that Street and Smith paid for heralding Gibson, or Maxwell Grant in that case, for typing up 1,440,000 words in less than 10 months on a Corona typewriter. I'll be sure to include not only that ad on the post for this podcast on The Retroist, but a link to the ShadowSanctum.net as well. Many of the elements that made the character of the Shadow stand out were born out of the Living Shadow. Naturally, the maniacal and unnerving laughter, his cloak and slouched hat, this outfit allows him to use his training to masterfully blend into the darkness, numerous times hiding in plain sight with the criminals he is hunting none the wiser. It wouldn't be until the 1937 radio series for the character, co-created by Gibson and Edward Hale Bierstadt, that the Shadow would gain the ability to, quote, cloud men's minds, end quote. A talent that would eventually be incorporated into the novels themselves. Featured in this first story was also the Shadow's Girasol ring, a reddish-purple ring that in later stories, readers would learn was actually a gift from the Tsar of Russia. Also, as would be explained in a future story, the Shadow would be given an additional Girasol by an Incan tribe. It turns out that both jewels were originally the eyes to an Incan idol. Also introduced in The Living Shadow would be the Sanctum, that place where the Shadow could rest and plan his next step in the war on crime and would-be world conquerors. In addition, the Shadow's fondness for writing clues in messages in disappearing ink was first revealed in Gibson's debut story. The Shadow's twin 45 automatic pistols, which he uses when he needs to permanently end evil, didn't come until later. At least for the Living Shadow, he was more than glad to use his fists, as he is an expert at jujitsu. For what it's worth, I wasn't able to personally read this first story of the Shadow until I was a young adult. It was my first trip to the San Diego Comic-Con when I happened upon a used book dealer. I immediately told him I was interested in copies of the Shadow novels, and he was kind enough to steer me to a collection of reprints by Bantam from 1969. For my hard-earned $40, I walked away with The Living Shadow, a paperback reprint of that 1931 story, with a striking illustration by Sandy Cosson on its cover, featuring a cloaked image of the Shadow, firing those two 45 automatic pistols, his hawkish features given a devilish appearance thanks to his sinister smile. I'll be sure to include that image of this book in the Retroist article for this podcast. Obviously, the novels over the years began to add to the mythos of the Shadow, but the biggest reveal, I feel, came about very early, in the third Street and Smith story by Gibson entitled The Shadow Laughs. If you're a fan of the old-time radio series, you know that the Shadow is actually Lamont Cranston, a wealthy world traveler and socialite. The thing is, in the pulps, Lamont Cranston is not the Shadow. Although the two men apparently resemble each other so closely that when Cranston was off on some adventure, the Shadow would impersonate him. which Cranston learns when returning from a trip in South America, finding that people about town mention seeing him recently, which, as you might imagine, troubles the wealthy young man. A few days later, while Cranston is alone, he is visited by the Shadow, who removes his hat and cloak to reveal a spitting image of the socialite. If that wasn't frightening enough, the Shadow tells him,
"Some people call me the Shadow. That is but one identity. I have other personalities that I assume as easily as I don my black cloak and hat. One of my personalities is that of Lamont Cranston. In the past, I have used it while you were away. At present, I choose to use it now. It would be embarrassing for us to both be here. So you must go."
Last quote from the pulp stories, I promise. The reason for the Shadow pretending to be Cranston is it allowed him access to higher social circles, making contacts in the police force and so on. Surprisingly, Cranston is kind of cool with all of this and decides to take off for Europe. In time, Cranston would in fact become another agent of the Shadow, going so far as to help keep tabs on the stable of agents for the Shadow when he was away. Alright, with 325 original novels featuring the Shadow, there's no way I could touch on everything. Besides, I'm hoping you'll track down the many reprints of the stories themselves, so you can learn all about the Shadow's loyal agents like Burbank, Mo Shrevenitz, Cliff Marcelin, and Jericho Droop, to name a few. However, I'm going to reveal who the Shadow really is. We learn that the Shadow is actually Kent Allard, an aviator in World War I, that after deciding to fight crime and protect the innocence of the city, he faked his own death in Guatemala, so he could use the skills he learned, like becoming a master of disguise, to begin his war on crime. This wouldn't be revealed until a 1937 story entitled The Shadow and Masks. Fun fact, as already mentioned, Gibson was responsible for 282 of the Shadow novels. Other writers who occasionally were called to help included Theodore Tinsley, Bruce Elliott, Richard Wormser, as well as Lester Dent, all under the pseudonym of Maxwell Grant, of course. That is in fact the reason so many authors took pen names, because the publishers wanted the audience to think there was only a single author. Now listeners, Lester Dent is very important indeed, as under the mandated pen name of Kenneth Robson, he was responsible for the creation of another equally important pulp hero for Street and Smith Publications. That would be Doc Savage. The Detective Story Hour ceased broadcasting on March 27, 1935. That was okay, though, because it allowed for the Shadow to return to the airwaves in his own radio series on September 26, 1937. And if the Shadow acting as narrator for that former radio series was popular, the 17-year run on this new radio series should help to show how much the public embraced this version of the pulp hero. And what a way for the Shadow to return, voiced by none other than Orson Welles, as both Lamont Cranston and the Shadow. In addition, he had a companion on the program, Margot Lane, a confidant and romantic interest. She alone knew Cranston was in fact the Shadow. Margot was played by Agnes Moorehead, who you might know better as Endora, the mother of Samantha from the popular TV series Bewitched, or perhaps the mute old woman from the exceptional 1961 Twilight Zone episode, The Invaders.
I told Albold to serve our coffee here in the library, unless you'd rather go on the terrace.
No, I prefer it here.
Then let me see you smile. That frown is most unbecoming.
Lamont, give it up.
Give what up, my dear? Drinking coffee?
I'm serious, Lamont Cranston. When I foolishly let you know that... Do you remember what you said? It will be exactly 5 years next week.
But there's still so much to do, Margot.
Well, then let somebody else do it. Don't you realize that you can't keep on like this forever? Someone's certain to identify you, and when that someone does, someone else is certain to kill you.
Perhaps, but until they do... Oh, darling, stop frowning.
I don't mean necessarily to give up your work, Lamont, but this other... Let the Shadow just disappear and come out openly.
Margot, thanks to the radio series, would become entwined with the Shadow mythos, making the leap to the pulps themselves beginning in 1941. And if you think fandom getting up in arms about Game of Thrones or Star Wars is something new, when Margot made her appearance in that 1941 issue, the Shadow magazine received quite a bit of hate mail from longtime readers of the Shadow. By the way, Orson Welles did not provide the who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men line. That was reused from the Frank Riddick Jr. narrations. I've read that the actor accomplished his eerie voice by speaking into a water glass next to the microphone. As I already mentioned, the character of the Shadow was given the ability to cloud men's minds, so he could remain invisible to the criminals he was hunting. This was done because it was quite a bit easier to explain to the listeners why he wasn't being seen, using hypnosis instead of trying to describe how the character was just hiding within the blackness of the shadows of a room, etc. One thing that should be added concerning differences between the pulp incarnation of the character and the radio version is the lack of memorable villains. Now, granted, I've not had the opportunity to listen to every single Shadow radio show, but the likes of Shiwan Khan, the last living descendant of Genghis Khan, to me, was the Moriarty to the Shadow's Sherlock Holmes, possessing telepathy and even a touch of clairvoyance, as well as attaining invisibility himself by suspending his action of thought. He kept the Shadow and his agents on their toes. The bad guys in the radio series tended to be mobsters or agents of foreign powers, although there were the likes of voodoo priestesses and such. I'm sure the reason is much like with the Shadow's ability to cloud men's minds. It was easier on the show if they stuck with more grounded enemies. Although, having said that, at least the radio show did include Police Commissioner Ralph Weston from the Pulps. To be blunt, in the 30-minute format of the radio show, it would have been rather difficult if they injected the Shadow's agents to focus on while trying to tell a story and not take away the majority of the running time from the likes of Margot and Lamont, as well as his costumed alter ego. It might be because I heard of the exploits of the Shadow from my grandparents first, their memories of the radio show, and then listening to those original broadcasts on cassette tape, before getting to read my first Gibson story, but I kind of prefer the radio version of the character. While he might not have been whipping out those 45 automatics to deal with criminals, and he often gave the evildoer a chance to refrain from violent action, the Shadow was still, in my mind, very threatening and dangerous in the radio show. Wells would only play the character for one season, being replaced by Bill Johnstone on the September 25th, 1938 episode of the series. Johnstone would play the character until 1943, when Brett Morrison would step in to fill the cape and cowl of the Shadow. Morrison would be replaced in September of 1944 by John Archer, who himself would be replaced by Steve Courtley in 1945 for a grand total of 7 episodes, before Morrison would return and continue to voice both Cranston and the Shadow until the series' last episode, entitled Murder by Sea, which was broadcast on December 26, 1954. Agnes Moorehead was not the only actress to voice Margot Lane throughout the series' run, although she portrayed the character until 1940, when Marjorie Anderson took over until 1944, when Grace Matthew portrayed Margot until Gertrude Warner accepted the part in 1949, and would stay with the show until its final episode in 1954. I cannot tell you how many times back in the day I listened to the Shadow radio show on those handful of cassette tapes. I didn't really have any friends that I could hang out with until my high school years. Many long nights when summer break was in effect, I would lay in my bed with these massive headphones over my ears, looking at the light from the stereo setup in my room as I listened to many of those performers I just mentioned. It was, in fact, the reason why in high school I ended up creating a Shadow-inspired character of my own for the local public access channel, a character called The Apparition. While I was lucky enough to receive front page coverage in the local newspaper, and even produced a few episodes that aired, let's just say that I do not have 1/10 of the talent of Walter B. Gibson, obviously. The popularity of the Shadow radio show, in addition to the pulp novels, led the character being adapted into a syndicated newspaper strip beginning on June 17, 1940, written by Gibson with illustrations by Bringing Up Fathers, Vernon Green. The series' stories were kind of taken from Gibson's earlier novels, but it found itself being canceled in 1942, mainly due to the paper shortages involved in World War II. Around this time, Street and Smith also realized how many kids were getting swept up by the character, as they began producing Shadow Comics, starting in March of 1940. The series ran for 101 issues, the last issue hitting stands on September of 1949. An item of interest, until this comic book series, the Shadow wasn't illustrated or described as having the red scarf covering the lower portion of his face, leaving his often overly large, hawkish nose and eyes visible beneath his slouched hat. Although, the pulp illustrations themselves would soon feature this new article of clothing. Honestly, it really works for the character, especially in action shots, his black cloak billowing with that blood-red scarf behind him. Just visually pleasing, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. Also, in 1941, Street and Smith began to heavily market the character to kids, not just in those comic books, but in merchandising. You could pick up a Shadow board game for a single dollar. The Shadow pencil light for those times when you needed to write messages in the dark. This automatic pencil could be yours for 50 cents. Or, for another dollar, you could purchase the official Shadow hat and cape. Or even Big Little books featuring the character for 10 cents. The first released being The Shadow and the Living Death. Or even as something as simple as marbles. Each with a side view of the Shadow imprinted on it, holding out a .45 automatic. Back to the Shadow comics, he even managed to make appearances in the likes of Mad Magazine, with issue number 4, courtesy of Harvey Kurtzman and Will Elder. Even Archie Comics in 1964 attempted to revive the Shadow. Releasing 8 issues in total, this short-lived run, after the first issue, became standard superhero fare, switching the character's trademark cloak and cowl for a standard superhero-looking green and blue costume. This series was handled by Robert Bernstein and John Rosenberger, although, interestingly enough, a few of the later issues were written by none other than Superman co-creator Jerry Siegel. DC Comics took a stab in 1973 to returning the Shadow to his roots, with a 12-issue maxi series, courtesy of Denny O'Neil of Batman fame, and now legendary Shadow illustrator Michael Kaluta. Although, to be fair, the artist only illustrated issues 1 through 4 and issue 6, with Frank Robbins and E.R. Cruz illustrating the remaining issues. The comic itself was set in the 1940s. Speaking of Batman, did you know that Gotham's Dark Knight met the Shadow not once, but twice? In Batman, number 253, which was published in November of 1973, Batman teams up with a now-aged Shadow. The Caped Crusader admits that the exploits he read of the Dark Avenger inspired him as a kid. In Batman number 259, which was published in December of 1974, in a story entitled The Night of the Shadow, we learn that the Shadow actually saved the life of both Bruce Wayne and his father when a criminal named Willie Hank Stamper held up the bank they were in. As the story unfolds, it's been 25 years since that incident, and the criminal is bent on getting revenge on those people left alive in the bank. It's up to Batman and the Shadow to stop Stamper, which they obviously do. By the end of the story, the Shadow reveals to Batman that he indeed knows he is Bruce Wayne. Because the Shadow knows, of course. Not that he would ever divulge the Dark Knight's secret identity. DC Comics kept the Shadow revival going with their 1986 miniseries, a then-modern take on the character courtesy of Howard Chaykin, entitled The Shadow, Blood and Judgment. Gone were the Shadow's trusted .45 automatics, replaced by Chaykin with twin Uzis. This series led to an ongoing series, but this version was more akin to Harry Steger's pulp character of the Spider, ready to shoot first and ask questions later. More Punisher than costume crime fighter. The ongoing series began in 1987 and lasted for 19 issues, with artwork by Bill Sienkiewicz as well as Kyle Baker. It was in 1988 when Denny O'Neil and Michael Kaluta, with inker Russ Heath, would team back up to produce a graphic novel featuring the Shadow for Marvel Comics in a World War II story entitled The Shadow, Hitler's Astrologer. DC Comics again released a new Shadow comic series set in the 1930s called The Shadow Strikes, and it was written by Gerard Jones with artwork by Eduardo Barreto. This series lasted until 1992, with the copyright holders to the character, Condé Nast, raising their licensing fees for the character, which prompted DC to cease publication of the series with issue 31. However, The Shadow and Lamont Cranston, although never officially mentioned by name, were expertly used by the late and great Dave Stevens for his Rocketeer comic series, published by Comico in 1988 and 1989. Although the ending of what is now known as Cliff's New York Adventure wasn't completed until 1995, and that was published by Dark Horse Comics. I'll be getting to the Rocketeer in another podcast. Dark Horse Comics began producing their own Shadow series in 1993, tapping Michael Kaluta and Joel Gross to write and illustrate In the Coils of the Leviathan, as well as an additional three-part miniseries entitled Hell's Heatwave. The Shadow even appeared in an issue with the popular Dark Horse heroine, Ghost, in 1995. Also, in that same year, the last Dark Horse-produced comic book Shadow series was released, entitled The Case of the Shrieking Skeletons. This time, he would be crossing paths with Doc Savage. Let's just say that the Shadow and Doc Savage don't exactly see eye to eye on how things should be done. Actually, friends, think of the opposing ideology of Superman and Batman, and you'll get the picture. Back in 2012, the Shadow returned to comic book stands thanks to Dynamite Entertainment, and continues today, with series being released by a variety of creators, such as Garth Ennis and Matt Wagner, and has featured the character crossing paths with the likes of not just the Spider, but Grendel and the Green Hornet, and even recently teaming up with Batman again in a dual company crossover, with a miniseries produced by both DC Comics as well as Dynamite Entertainment. Okay, there's one other aspect of the Shadow in pop culture I need to tackle before we are done. That is, of course, the character's appearance in film and television.
Weston speaking.
Shadow.
The Black Tiger is dead. You will find his body at the Arcade Garage.
Hello.
Now that voice you heard was Victor Yori as Lamont Cranston and the Shadow from the 1940 Columbia Pictures serial The Shadow. That, however, was not the first time the Street and Smith character had appeared on the big screen. Back in 1937, Grand National Pictures released The Shadow Strikes, which, as it turns out, was based on Walter B. Gibson's story The Ghost of the Manor. The film starred Rod LaRocque as both Cranston and the Shadow, who finds himself impersonating an attorney in an attempt to get to the bottom of a mystery. Then, in 1938, there was International Crime, which was based on one of Theodore Tinsley's stories entitled Foxhound. With the fact that the Shadow's name isn't mentioned in the title, it probably won't shock you to learn that the Shadow isn't exactly in the film itself. Although, Rod once again plays Lamont Cranston, a criminologist and detective with a daily radio show. Instead of Margot Lane, Astrid Alwyn portrays Phoebe Lane. And while some agents of the Shadow end up in the picture, many fans don't exactly consider this an actual Shadow film. Then came 1940's The Shadow serial. In this 15-chapter series, Victor Yori's version of the Shadow couldn't render himself invisible. He was most certainly seen in the familiar Shadow costume, though, and his foe was the Black Tiger, an enemy who could turn himself invisible, although, as you heard from that clip, it didn't do the monstrous villain much good in the end. Vedan Borg played Margot Lane, and in fact, the debut of the serial was June 1st, 1940, which just so happened to be the young woman's birthday. Also, from the pulp stories were Harry Vincent, played by Roger Moore, no, not that Roger Moore, as well as Inspector Joe Cardona, who was portrayed by Edward Peel Sr. I've seen some Shadow fans online who don't care for this serial, but I own it, and I honestly think that it's pretty great, to say the least. Victor Yori really does a great job, in my humble opinion. Of course, let me say right now, I am a huge fan of serials, whether it be the Commando Cody Republic Picture releases or Universal Pictures' wonderful adaptations of Alex Raymond's Flash Gordon with the legendary Buster Crabbe. While obviously not all serials were equal, a good handful of them still hold up. In 1946, Monogram Pictures licensed the rights to release three films, all released that year, with The Shadow Returns, Behind the Mask, and finally, The Missing Lady. Kane Richman played both Cranston and the Shadow for all three features. These films focused on Detective Lamont Cranston having to solve mysteries as the Shadow. As a bonus, in these films, he was allowed to become invisible. Margot Lane was played by Barbara Reed for all three pictures. And the original New York Times review was a little harsh on her performance. For what it's worth, Leonard Maltin felt the third film, The Missing Lady, was the best of the three, saying, quote, "The best of the series, played like a straight film noir and offering a few surprise twists," end quote. Then, in 1958, there was the theatrical release for Invisible Avenger, which was a film composed of elements of a 1957 television pilot by Republic Pictures, a proposed series for The Shadow, with Richard Dare playing Cranston and The Shadow. It was re-released in 1962 as Bourbon Street Shadows, since the location for this cobbled-together film took place in New Orleans. Now, by 1994, I was working at a local movie theater, the Malco Razorback 6, which if you've ever listened to an episode of the Saturday Frights podcast, you'll have probably heard me mention numerous times. Anyway, I had not been made head projectionist at this point, so from my position behind the snack bar, when the intercom crackled and Roger told me to take a couple minutes and rush into Auditorium 3 for the matinee showing of the Flintstones, I knew there was something that my friend wanted me to see. The lights dimmed, and as the projector kicked into life, I kind of lost my mind.
Consumed by evil.
For as long as you can remember, you've struggled against your own black heart.
Shoot through him.
Every man pays a price for redemption.
I'm not looking for redemption.
You have no choice. But I'll teach you to use your black shadow to fight evil.
He became the Shadow.
I didn't see anything, I swear.
Dump him.
Who's there?
Did you think you'd get away with it? Did you think I wouldn't know? Now, when the world is in danger...
Report.
Police investigation of murder. Agent advises inquiry.
Who knows what powers stir in the night?
Whatever you did, it's in the past.
Join me. Inside you beats a heart of darkness. I do what I do to fight back the evil inside me, but some part of it is still there, waiting.
Genghis Khan conquered half of the world in his lifetime. I intend to finish the job.
And when the adventure begins...
Activate the bomb.
Who knows where it will end? Alec Baldwin, John Lone, Penelope Ann Miller, and Tim Curry. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow.
A couple of tidbits about that trailer. The Shadow's voice in that trailer was intended to sound a little like the way Orson Welles performed the character in the radio series. Kind of tinny. It didn't sound like that at all in the finished film. Plus, there are actually a few deleted scenes in this trailer, like Lamont explaining the darkness always within him. Plus, that laugh at the end was from Tim Curry, not Alec Baldwin. Baldwin would naturally play both Lamont Cranston and The Shadow. Screenwriter David Coep, who had hit it big with his screenplay for 1993's Jurassic Park, delivered a script that was a period piece, pitting The Shadow and a few of his agents, along with Margot Lane, played by the beautiful Penelope Ann Miller, against Siwan Khan, wonderfully played by John Lone. The rights to The Shadow had been picked up by producer Martin Bregman back in 1982. Bregman would work with Coep to get the tone of the script right. It turns out that David himself had listened to The Shadow radio shows when it was rebroadcast on CBS in his youth, which is why the film is an entertaining mashup of not just the radio series, but the pulp novels too. In addition, the film has an embarrassment of riches in regards to the supporting cast, like Sir Ian McKellen as Margot Lane's father, Dr. Reinhardt Lane, or the already mentioned Tim Curry as Farley Claymore. Peter Boyle played loyal shadow agent and taxicab driver extraordinaire Mo Shrevenitz, with the legendary funny man Jonathan Winters as Cranston's uncle, Commissioner Wainwright Barth. As for the plot of the film, I'm not going to go all in with full spoilers here, because there is a good chance you might not have taken the time to see the film for yourself. It sadly didn't perform well at the box office. I'll be the first to admit that the movie is far from perfect, but I personally feel it deserved to do a whole lot better. Everyone really gave it their all. No one in the cast was holding back in delivering a throwback to the pulp adventure films, especially not director Russell Mulcahy of Highlander fame. Bear in mind that by 1994, we'd experienced the all-consuming Batmania from 1989's Batman, And then there was 1990's Dick Tracy, as well as 1991's The Rocketeer and 1992's Batman Returns. In my honest opinion, the critics of the time really didn't get what the movie was going for, that throwback vibe I just mentioned. I think, sadly, this was the same case with 1996's The Phantom. Back to the plot for 1994's The Shadow. As the film opens, we are introduced to Ying Ko, an opium drug warlord who is in reality Lamont Cranston, a man so consumed with hatred and rage he has fled the civilized world, giving in to his baser instincts. Fun fact, Ying Ko means dark or black eagle, which is one of the names that pilot Kent Allard was known by in the Gibson novels. Cranston is kidnapped by agents of the Tulku, a holy man who sees the evil within Cranston, and decides to forcibly redeem him, allowing him the knowledge to dip into that darkness for good, being able to alter his own physical appearance, revealing his true self, perhaps. Lamont, as we are told, trains with the Tulku for 7 years, before returning back to New York City to wage war against crime, now with the ability to hypnotize others, as well as read their thoughts, and become invisible if he so wishes. In New York City, we witness the Shadow come to the rescue of Dr. Roy Tam, played by Saab Shimano, stopping a mob boss named Duke Rollins from having his men throw the frightened man, whose feet are encased in a block of cement, over the Brooklyn Bridge. Afterwards, as Mo Shrevenant arrives to pick up both the Shadow and Dr. Tam, taking the frightened man home, the Shadow informs the good doctor that he is now one of his agents. After dropping Tam off, Cranston visits the Cobalt Club for a little chat with his uncle, and this is where he meets Margot Lane. The two immediately have an attraction to each other, right off the bat, until near the end of the evening, when Cranston, to his horror, realizes that Margot has a touch of telepathy. A dangerous romance for a man trying to keep his alter ego of the Shadow a secret, wouldn't you say? He's about to learn he has even bigger worries, as Shiwan Khan has recently arrived in New York City, traveling in the sarcophagus of his ancestor Genghis Khan. He has not only set his sights on New York City being his first area of conquest, but tries to lure Cranston back to the side of darkness. You see, Shiwan Khan was also a student of the Tulku, before he murdered him. I'm going to stop right there with the synopsis. The Shadow, like I said, is a fun movie, even if due to budget issues there are a few things like a handful of unfinished special effects. It's noticeable, but doesn't wreck the picture. Actually, the ending as it stands now was by necessity cobbled together, with just what they had to work with. The original intended ending to the film was meant to be quite a bit more impressive. Sadly, the set they were going to use was destroyed by the January 17th Northridge earthquake, an earthquake of a 6.7 magnitude. Now don't get me wrong, in hindsight, I'm very glad that we fans of The Shadow were lucky enough to get a big screen adaptation. In addition, I was able to buy all manner of toys and collectibles, like the Topps trading card set, and a pretty awesome board game too. It's just that I still wish this would have been the first step in a series of Shadow films. But who knows what the future might bring? With new comics and books being produced, perhaps there is another Shadow film in the future. I guess only the Shadow knows for certain. Friends, I believe that brings us to the end of this episode and my broad overview of the history of the Shadow. First of all, I want to thank you again for taking the time to listen to what I had to share about the Shadow. And I do apologize about the tardiness of this episode. In truth, it's hard to write at the arcade or even at my day job. I'll try to do a little better with the next episode. For what it's worth, you can generally find me every single day writing on the Retroist site, as well as the Diary of an Arcade Employee and Saturday Fright's Facebook page. If you have any comments on the podcast or maybe a suggestion for a future episode, you can contact me at vicsage@retroist.com. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our show is courtesy of Earl Green's thelogbook.com, kindly used with his permission. Naturally, we need to thank the Retroist himself, not just for hosting this new podcast, but for creating a spot on the internet where we fans of all things retro can get a weekly dose. When you need your retro fix, and we all do, hop on over to the Retroist. Our next episode is going to be a special one, much like with the first show where I invited fellow Retroist authors and various podcasters to share their memories of Christmas and the holidays. This next special will be all about summer. Favorite summer movie, vacation memories, you get the idea. One last thing, the Pop Culture Retrorama podcast is available on iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify. If you like the show, why not give us a good rating and leave us a few words to help us attract new listeners? This has been a RetroWest production. Thank you for listening, and have a better one. Goodbye.